starting now.
I don't know how good it's gonna be, but I've been listening to a lot of Radiolab. Because I like Radiolab.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I wanna try doing some more found sound stuff for the podcast. This is our murder basement and the shop. Hi. Rose, close the door behind you. Come on in so the cat doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
I was just telling Krista, it's like, it's so bizarre right now because I'm coming out of just being listening to you, to your voice for an hour.
Friends, welcome to the What Is Life podcast. We're a conversational podcast about interesting people who do interesting things. And we've got our first like in-person podcast today. It's super cool. I'm your co-host, Chris Furness.
I'm your other co-host, Jenny Co.
And I'm Mike Mecha Choi Choi.
All right, Mike is our guest co-host today. Welcome, Mike.
Thank
You're
you.
In our house.
I am. I'm here. I invited myself over. I was insistent. I wanted the magic of the in-person experience.
And now you've staked your claim to the first.
Yeah.
Now, now he lives in our house. Yeah.
This is my room. Welcome.
Appreciate it. For those who might not know you or might know you, what would people know you from?
A few different things. I mean, in general, it feels weird to say it this way, but I'm like an all around creator.
Yes. Maker of things.
If you know me from, you might know me from making the Flip Grip, which is this vertical accessory for the Nintendo Switch that I made a couple years back, and we could talk all about that.
Yeah.
I also just put a lot of random crap out on Twitter. That's some intersection of engineering and video games and music and design. I made an exercise bike that connects to Mario Kart, earlier this year. That was not nearly as popular as I hoped it would be. I also do a lot of music stuff because I play a lot of video game music. I'm a self-taught musician, and so I do a lot of Twitch streaming now, especially during... I started during the quarantine, basically, and that's been a huge part of my life, but music and video game music has always been a big part of my life. So you might know me from any one of those things or just some weird, post that I've made on Twitter about some stupid video game thing.
So you actually do, like... Music kind of musicians astound me, especially when they're like able to improvise like you do. So when you do your Twitch streams, correct me if I'm wrong, you take requests.
Yeah.
And you just do them. Like,
absolutely.
From your head.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, you were talking in an earlier podcast about forcing functions. And I think Twitch is, for me, it's been many things. But the reason why I got into it in the first place was because it was a forcing function for perfectionism, for anti-perfectionism.
Ah.
Because I remember just trying to record music and... I don't play the same thing twice ever because I just can't really. And that's not supposed to be a flex. I really wish I could, but I really can't. And so, Twitch stream was a good way for me to be able to, take requests, which is something that I love doing. Mm-hmm. I love like making people, happy by hearing a song that's nostalgic for them.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you make a mistake, it's just lost in time. You know, it's just part of it. And you can't, there's no record button. You just press go and it's very spontaneous in that way. And for me, it was a huge, it was a big help for me getting over the activation energy of trying to record like an album, which I've never done.
Yeah.
I would love to do it one day, but I just can't.
That's interesting. Cause you know, I am new to creation. I like to say, you know, other than creating humans, right? And
that's easy.
Yeah.
And fun.
But like as a new creator, and I think I've dealt with this in the past before. Like, you know, I've always dealt with like perfectionism and like imposter syndrome as like just parts of my identity.
Yeah.
But it's like I'm coming to grips with like, what is the balance between like shipping something versus refining something?
Yeah. Well, there are all sorts of blockers that people have. I think that's worth talking about too, when it comes to creation, because like you have all these expectations that you're putting on yourself or that you think that other people are putting on. And like, it's interesting that you were trying to find a forcing function to get you to break through these expectations you were having of perfection.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, I think about my early days of radio in college, right? Like, you know, 20 years ago, I went to college and joined the college radio station. And one of the first things that the station manager told me during my DJ training was, don't admit your mistakes on air.
Right? Oh, I see.
Like, don't say, oops, I messed that up or whatever. Just keep going, right? Because just like you said with the Twitch stream, it's just lost to time.
Yeah.
Right? And you just keep going.
And oftentimes, and nobody's gonna notice. Your audience doesn't notice.
Or care, unless you actually point it out.
Yeah.
Right? Because they can't do what you do, maybe. Yeah. Right? And so they're like, well, what you're doing is incredible anyway. So it's like when you're a visual artist and you're drawing or painting or whatever, and like you see it all the time when people are self-deprecating about their work, right?
Right.
Like, oh, this sucks or whatever.
That's my whole vibe.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very self-deprecating. Yeah. So it is just because usually I'm like, look at me, I did this dumb thing.
But then when people who maybe feel like they can't do that then see you being self-deprecating, they're like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
Like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like, right, I can't do that. And then they feel bad in a way.
Even worse about their existence.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that there's something to be said for picking apart all of the individual blockers that we all have as creators and finding ways to address those.
Yeah.
Just identifying them.
Yeah. You know? Like, for example, so ever since I started on this, like, you know, knife making journey, blacksmithing journey, I started a new like Instagram account to sort of like document that.
Oh, yeah.
And the purpose of that account is really for myself, so that I document the things that I'm learning, the mistakes that I'm making, like, you know, the process that I'm going through, right? And the overall progress that I'm making.
Right.
But as I'm doing, you know, but in this account, it's like, I call myself an aspiring knife maker, and, you know, anyone that I talk to now, they're just like, what are you talking about? You're doing it.
You're
like
doing it.
You are out there, you're forging, you're doing shit. And I'm like, yeah, but I still haven't made a fucking knife like by myself, like a whole knife I have not done yet by myself. And it's like, I put this arbitrary kind of like notion on myself that like, I'll be a knife maker once I do this thing. And now I've given myself this like out, you know, where it's like, no, you can just never do that. And you never have to call yourself a knife maker.
Sure.
You know?
Well, I encounter that too in the game space, where it's like, people are like, I'm an aspiring game maker. Here's a game that I made. And it's like, dude, you made a game.
You are a game maker.
Like, you don't have to be aspiring anything. Yeah. And the only, like, it's worth unpacking too what that term, that label, aspiring, does for you.
I think for me, it's a way to pay tribute to the ones that came before me. And pay respect to what they've done for the domain.
So the craft.
Do you feel like people who are knife makers would look at you if you were claiming to be a knife maker and see you as somebody who was an imposter?
I definitely have that fear. It is a very real fear that, you know, perhaps I don't always like to admit.
Yeah.
For sure.
That happens all the time in music. I mean, I feel that way in music. Yeah. It's not something that I talk about very often. Not because I feel like I'm, you know, hugely, I try not to think about it too much, because it's not always entirely productive. But as a self-taught musician, when I'm on Twitter and I see classically trained musicians, and I'm also, a lot of my music is very jazz oriented.
Right.
And jazz is both accessible and very, very inaccessible at the same time. And so for me, because I don't have any training, I just kind of play something. I'm like, that sounds like jazz. That sounds like some approximation of jazz. And maybe a layperson will look at that and say, yeah, it sounds like jazz. He hit some wrong notes in there.
Right.
But, you know, a a real jazz. I always think, what would a real jazz musician think? What would this, like, I have multiple people in my mind who I really look up to. Mm-hmm. What would they look at and think of this music if I'm calling it jazz?
Because,
you know, sometimes I'll see them go, you know, I'll see some people go on a diatribe about like, oh, what's jazz? What's not? Like, mm-hmm. these people are calling it jazz and all mm-hmm. these things. You know, I put like a cheesy sax on everything. It's like, hey, that's jazz. but
it's called the jazzy
sax. Right, exactly. But I do think a lot about that echelon of people in my head and how much respect I have for them and how much, you know, ultimately I care about what they think.
But then you're also hinging your happiness and your fulfillment on somebody else's expectations at that
point. Yeah.
And when you think about it and you actually think about those people that you admire, most of the time, if you talk to them about that, imposter syndrome being what it is and being the useless emotion that it is, you talk to them about it and they're like, yeah, I feel the same way. Or like you look at like, you know, not that they're the greatest ever, but like the Beatles, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or any of like the formative kind of like rock greats, they didn't know how to read music for the longest time, right? Yeah. And they were still making really good music because they intuitively learned and they were absorbing all of the things that they were interested in. And that's the stuff that's really important, not the expectations that you put on yourself about creation.
Totally. Because
when you are aspiring, you don't have the confidence of somebody who has shipped something and knows what finishing something looks like yet.
Right.
So it's understandable that you're going to be looking to other sources for that kind of information.
Yeah. I think it's also like a product of like, you know, how I grew up and how I felt like I was judged, you know, especially like, I don't know, like Korean parents, man, like I love my parents and they meant well, you know, their intent was to try and help me.
Yeah.
But it was so harmful in so many ways that they probably just didn't even realize, you know, it's like, I literally lived with the, where are the other 2 points, you know, when I didn't get a perfect score on an exam or something. And so I never looked at the whole that was good. I only saw the faults because that was what I was trained to see early on.
Yeah. And we can have empathy for our parents because they're all, you know, I assume that everybody's doing their best all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's not like they were intentionally trying to damage.
Exactly. But. So it's like, I grew up knowing that my parents loved me. Yeah. Right. But their intent and their impact was not always aligned.
So how did your parents destroy you?
You know, it's interesting because I feel like one of the ways that we've connected, or at least I feel like I got connected through you, is just being on Instagram and seeing the food that you're cooking.
Yeah.
And that's something that is really big for me. If we're talking about
connections,
things that you're passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Like for me, I'm really passionate about Korean cooking. And so, you know, for me, that's something that for the past 6 or 7 years, like I've been trying every day to like make something and, you know, make Korean food, basically really dig deep into all the nitty gritty, like, how, you know, where do you get your garlic? How do you grind it? How do you get the most out of these different flavors? And it's been a really, really fascinating space for me. For me, a big part of it is my dad has a background in cooking. He's not in the restaurant business anymore. But for me, I grew up, my mom passed away when I was young, you know, and so I think a big part of it for me is trying to, you know, I think a lot of people still have access, you know, people whose parents are still around, especially Korean parents, right? That's such an important part of Korean culture is the food and showing love through food. Yeah. And so I think for me, part of it is trying to rebuild what I don't have from being able, you know, not growing up with a mom.
Yeah.
You know, luckily I had my dad. He's an incredible cook and he's able to just make anything in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I think that's been a big part of that journey for me creatively has been trying to reconnect with my culture through that way.
Hmm. No, that makes tons of sense.
Yeah.
You know, because I've recently, like, Korean food has always been like a big part of my life, but I've always shunned like other parts of like being Korean. I think a lot of it was media. right. you know, for me. And so reconnecting with like music and entertainment recently and finding representation in entertainment, yeah. that's been like a really big way to kind of connect with my heritage.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, and like one way that you and I connected when we first got together was through food and cooking.
Yes.
Because right? I, you know, being a white person, didn't grow up in a Korean household.
How dare you?
I know.
But I did grow up with a close family friend who was Chinese uh-huh. and spent just a massive amount of time at their house. And yeah. he was in the restaurant industry too. So the environment was there. I was very familiar with like Asian grocery stores and just Asian food in general. But I didn't prefer it. And so, you know, my style of cooking tends to be like French or Italian and like more, homey kind of things, homey white stuff. I have to you know, not generalize, you know, homey means different things to different people. Getting together with Ginny, we were trying to impress each other, cooking together. And we really liked the way that we cooked together. That was a big indicator of our relationship strength was how we danced in the kitchen.
Cause I think initially it was just like, oh, he made that. Well, I'm going to make this and I'm going to impress him with this. And then it was just like, after a while, we're like, this is silly. Why don't we just cook together?
Yeah. Well, you found a lot of parallels too, between the different styles of cooking. So like I prefer cooking things very simply, where it's like I get high quality ingredients and treat them right. And that's Korean cooking.
Yeah. Right?
That's like, you know, you get you try to do a lot with a little and you express your love and you express this idea of like plentifulness through what you can do with that.
You make a
ingredient.
You make a soup out of bones.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you basically boil bones.
And then you eat it for like 3 days and it's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean.
It's
like
bone soup with salt. And it's like the greatest meal of all.
Yes. And you have to add the salt.
Yes.
It's a DIY soup.
Yes.
Everything Korean's like that. Like, I think it's so funny during the pandemic. You know, Korean barbecue is obviously really popular.
Yeah.
And then during the pandemic, you know, in Koreatown, I was driving past all these places and the Korean barbecue places, they're just selling raw meat, which I think is hilarious. And people are like, oh, I went to Suwon Garbi the other day. I got some meat. And I was like, that's just a meat store.
Yeah.
Now they're not even like, you have to grill it yourself. You're like, you have to take it home, grill it in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And we're still going to make money off of that.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's so good.
Oh, my goodness.
But I love, like, you know, when Ginny's mom, when my mother-in-law comes and visits too, because she is like the quintessential, you know, Korean grandma.
Yeah.
She is Haemony. And so she will, her whole thing is showing love through food and cooking. And like, you know, we were talking earlier when you came to, you know, about like the kimchi fridge that she got for us.
Yeah.
When she got the kimchi fridge, she spent a week making kimchi, a year's worth of kimchi for us.
Right. To like fill it up.
She went and got giant plastic tubs and all the Napa cabbage and was just slowly massaging the cabbage for like a week, you know, like, that's love.
Yeah, totally. That's what, I mean, I feel like that's what I've been trying to learn too, is like, it's just all it's really just, some of this stuff is just a real pain in the neck to make, like, you know, grinding all the garlic and like, you look at how people make kimchi and people don't realize because you know, they give it out for free.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And not only that, like, you know, just the growing the peppers, right? Yeah. And then making sure you roast them, dry it out, and then you've got to like grind up the peppers into flakes.
Right.
And it's just like, it's a fucking process just to get the peppers.
Yeah.
So tying that back to perfectionism, when a, you know, Korean, you know, Haemony or Harabaji or, you know, an older Korean person is making you this loving meal and everything, do they also experience imposter syndrome? Do they also experience this?
No, because
definitely not.
When they're creative.
No, of course not.
So what's the difference?
I think the difference is that they're doing it for others.
Yeah.
You and know, they're survival. Doing it out of love.
And survival.
And survival. Right?
Yeah.
And for me, it's like an expression of self, because I've never had a way to, like, you know, like for me, it's hard to think about like my life as like living my life for me.
Right.
Because I don't know how to do that. I am learning how to do that now.
You're tying your identity to something that is new.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or I'm tying my identity to something that isn't like my corporate identity.
Right. Yeah.
I've had to shed like almost 2 decades of corporate identity.
Right.
Yeah.
To actually figure out like, what am I? Who am I?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, in imposter syndrome's been a big part of it. But I think as I'm figuring out like, no, I can actually do the shit. I am actually doing this shit. And the more I stay present and stay grounded and I am doing this.
Yeah.
You know, and product, I really don't use productivity as a term anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's like banned in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm no longer productive. It's like I'm motivated or I have momentum, you know, and I try not to focus so much on the output and I'm focusing more on the journey.
Yeah.
But my goal, it's super interesting that I tied this, like calling myself a knife maker to an output.
Oh yeah. That is interesting. You know? What is it? Yeah. What is it about the term productivity that bristles you? So
I think it's a state. It's a fake. It's like a fake state. Where like perfection, because you can't be productive all the time.
Yeah.
It's just, it's not possible. It's not feasible. Yeah. We're not fucking robots.
Sure.
You know? Right. And sometimes in order to be productive or in order to create something, you need to be able to consume. Mm-hmm. And it's like, right. When you're thinking about productivity, like consumption seems bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I needed to take myself out of that and say, okay, no. It's a balance between creation and consumption.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like that's something that I spent some focused time on in my career, like in my games career, not the cartooning side of me, but the game side, where it's like, in order to be productive, in order to be a good user experience designer for games, I do have to consume lots of games.
Mm-hmm.
So like if I'm working on a project that's completely out of my area of interest for a game, then that becomes work. You know, if I have to go play a arena-based first-person shooter or something that I normally wouldn't play in order for it to, you know, do well in my job, that then becomes part of my productivity and my output, right? Because for me, the term productivity is definitely goal-oriented. It's focused on the production of something leading towards an output.
I think it's a little different because you've had a career that was based in creative output, whereas my output was less based in that, and it was more in like services and logistics and technology.
Metrics.
Yeah. Exactly.
And people.
Yeah. And so I feel like there's a different, I form different mappings to what is allowed and what is not allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting to mention that, you know, with the flip grip, that was definitely a thing.
I'm so excited to talk about flip grip.
Oh, really? You know about
yes.
it?
Yes.
You have one.
I'm always surprised when people know about
it. Yeah,
because we also like love Ikaruga. And so if there's any way for me to play Ikaruga in the native like vertical form, like I turned my CRT on its side and destroyed a CRT back in the GameCube days trying to play that. Wrote. So you were offering a perfect solution.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I just remember there are so many moments about that consumption versus creation during the development of that, because that took, you know, the better part of like a year for me to do. And I did almost everything for that. Mm-hmm. Almost like that's what made that project really exciting for me, was because I got to exercise every part of my brain that I don't typically get to exercise in my job as a product engineer. You know, I got to do a lot of the marketing and the industrial design and the packaging design and the graphic design and all these different things, and talking to the Kickstarter backers. You guys were talking about Kickstarter in the first episode. And I remember there was this one really crystallizing moment for me where I remember showing the first finished unit to Jeremy.
Yeah, Jeremy Parrish.
Jeremy Parrish. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were in a cafe in San Francisco, and I brought it up to him. And he's like, wow, so what have you been playing with it? And I was like, Nothing. I've been making the thing, Jeremy. Yeah. And he's like, he couldn't believe it. He's like, what? I was like, I guess I don't really need to play test it because it rotates the thing and it works, you know? But it was kind of this funny moment for me where I was realizing how little I was consuming during that time because I was just focused on
that. I understand that, intuitively.
You're right.
You know?
Well, there are also different ways to create things. And, you know, again, I run into this all the time in games where it's like, I think there are a lot of assumptions about how to create things that are games or games adjacent, you know, and there are people who are fans of games and there are people who create games. And fans of games think that, you know, it's required that if you work on a game, you have to like that game and you're just playing it all the time and you're iterating and you're like all into it. And it's like, no, actually, most of the games that I've worked on, I'm actually very fortunate to have worked on some very fun games. Like I worked on Bejeweled, which was like, I'm so grateful to have worked on one of the greatest games that have ever been created in humanity. Right.
Yeah.
But you don't have to like a game to work on it and to be effective at like producing things.
Like I want a boss fight books about Bejeweled.
No, I think it'll be
love Bejeweled.
Can I tell you something about Bejeweled?
Yeah.
That is blowing my mind. I didn't realize it until just now. I knew that you had worked on it, but that was one of the first bonding experiences I had with my wife, my now wife, Joanna, in high school. We would just be really close to each other, you know, shoulder to shoulder, just playing Bejeweled together.
That's so sweet.
That was huge for us, you know, and we're both huge puzzle gamers. Yeah. You know, I think that's the thing is like, people think flip grip, they're like, oh, this guy must be a shmup, like,
right.
Like junkie, yeah. You know, but for me, I'm like, oh, I just like playing puzzle games. I love puzzle games.
But you saw, like, so what was the impetus of it? You saw a need, well, and you wanted to solve a problem.
Well, the whole story of Flip Grip is actually really interesting. It actually starts, I mean, if I give you the long version of the story, it's, so in high school, I started street performing. I played melodica in Little Tokyo in LA, and I would play video game music. You know, there's all these people in Little Tokyo going there to go to Japanese stores. And so if I saw them with like a shirt or a keychain or something, like they had a Sailor Moon keychain, I would play a Sailor Moon theme song. And it was like this whole thing. And that was really, I think for me, where I discovered the sort of creative touchstone for me. Yeah. Like, this is why I like playing music, because I like making people feel nostalgic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I did that. And then there was a video of it that I sent to Fangamer at some point for their office cam segment. Like, hey, look, I'm playing Earthbound music, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're like, wow, it's really cool. Then I went to college, and then my friend won a ticket to PAX.
Nice.
And he was like, let's go. And I was like, all right, I'll go. This is PAX East. Okay. I thought, I don't really want to go and play wait in line and play games. Like, I wasn't really into that. I was like, I want to go see Fangamer's booth. Because that was like a whole production. Every year they're like doing this big booth.
Always a great booth.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I finally get to meet these people. And so it was kind of, actually now in retrospect, it's kind of creepy, but I was like, you know, I brought my melodica and I was like, maybe I'll go and find some place that I can, you know, street perform and just do that the whole weekend. I don't even care if I make money. I just, because that's why I did it in high school, was to raise money for college. And then, you know, I went and I messaged them and I said, hey, you know, Fangamer, like, you want some booth music?
Yeah.
I don't know what was going through my head at the time, but I just went for it. I just went for it. And they were like, yeah, totally. And that's when I met all those people. And they're just, I mean, as you know, they're just the nicest people ever. And they just totally welcomed me with open arms. And I got to hang out with them all weekend. I just played video game music at their booth all weekend.
That is so cool.
And so that's how I got connected with them. And then eventually they, you know, I told them, I was like, hey, well, you know, that's when they were kind of going into non-apparel
sort
of things.
Yeah.
And I could see that they were doing that. And my background is as a product developer for, you know, physical things, you know, products and like consumer electronics and that sort of thing, even though Flipgrip doesn't have any electronics in it, spoiler alert. You know, I told them, hey, like, you know, I remember emailing them. I said, hey, I had a really great time doing all these PAXes with you. And like, but just so you know, this is what I do. And I would love to work together on something in the future. Then fast forward like 3 years or something like that. And Reed emails me and Jeremy Parrish is CC'd. And I'm like, whoa. You know, cause I grew up watching him on the, you know, on the computer. Uh-huh. And then they were like, we want to do this. We want to make this vertical orientation accessory. And I told them, I was like, I know, like the thing, like the skills that I had accumulated up until that point of my life, mm-hmm. all aligned. Mm-hmm. It was just this equinox moment where I was like, I know exactly what this is.
That's right.
And it materialized in my head and I built it in 95% of what you see at Flipgrip. I built that in one weekend.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I just came over me and I was just like, I went in and I just made it. And then I showed it to them and they were like, yeah, that's it.
Some moments in life like that are just gold. You
know, yeah.
Where it's like, I can meet this task exactly as it needs to be met.
Yeah.
And you just have that confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what's funny is when I emailed them and said, hey, like, let's work together.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything. Yeah. I don't know why I emailed them because I did not have the skills that I needed to do Flipgrip at that time. But the time that had passed, I'm really grateful for it because, you know, 3 years had been
a seed.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you did.
Well, if there's one thing I know and love about Reed and John and everybody at Fangamer, it's that they are into big, ambitious ideas and unknowns.
Right? Yeah.
Like when, like we did our Kickstarter back in 2012, you know, we were their first fulfillment of a Kickstarter ever.
Right.
And it was a big unknown. It was like, how would this even work? You know, like, what are we going to make? How are we going to make it? How are we going to make it cheap? How are we going to like do all of the different tiers and budget it and everything?
Right.
We got that all wrong. But like we tried, you know, we did it.
Yeah.
And like having the ability to achieve what seems completely unachievable with people who are just like down for it.
Totally.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what was interesting about that was because that was also, I think it was sort of new for them as well, because it's, you know, it's a video game accessory. It's like a thing that needs to go around people's, you know, video game consoles. And there's all these things that you have to think about and, you know, you have to think about licensing. I mean, they do a lot of licensing, but like for a video game accessory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was a really interesting process for me because I was sort of, the buck stopped with me in a lot of places where I was like, do you think this is good enough?
And, yeah.
I had thankfully had enough professional experiences up until that point that I was able to kind of, you know, really drive that. And it was, ended up being one of the greatest experiences of my life because I met so many people through that.
Yeah.
I probably met you through that. I mean, sort of.
Probably.
I mean, I think a lot of people became aware of me because I was the, you know, this random Asian dude
Random Korean dude
who made this, accessory with, you know, Jeremy Parrish. Was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, no, well, because I had been reading Jeremy's stuff forever and then been connected to Fangamer. And I love weird, ambitious projects. I love little things like the Flipgrip. You know, I love thinking about interacting with games in a way that maybe the creator didn't intend or never could imagine. You know,
totally.
And for me as an artist, it is encouraging for like my own works to know that there's still room for people to go and remix and iterate and be inspired by things. And, you know, your work can live on after your work is done, basically.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that I'm like obsessed with is legacy. You know,
the more you lower the barrier for entry, right? The more diversity you're going to have in terms of your audience and the more diverse use cases you're going to have across that audience, right?
Yeah.
And so that diversity brings about like these new edge cases or whatever that creator would not have been able to think about from that one perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
And all it really takes is you to be open to it. Like, I think a lot about, you know, our kids are the generation that is growing up on YouTube and Friday Night Funkin' and like all of and Among Us and all of these games that are really like low barrier to entry in terms of quality, mm-hmm. but that actually makes it a little bit easier for people to go in and make their own mark in the space.
Right? Yeah.
Where it's like, Sonic fandom is like this, right? Where like Sega does not give a fuck about Sonic, obviously. Yeah. And so fans take over and the fans do remixes and stuff. And so you'll actually see a lot of like, if you look at like kids YouTube right now, it's a lot of whatever is memeified right now, but it's like Friday Night Funkin', Undertale, Sonic, yeah, all mashed up to the, and Five Nights at Freddy's and all this stuff that's
Minecraft.
Minecraft. Yeah. When you look at it, you're like, aesthetically, every one of those games is aesthetically unappealing. Right. Yeah. They're not refined. They're just sort of like, you know, Flash games or Newground games or even Minecraft. I'm like, I've always really disliked the Minecraft aesthetic. Like the pixel art makes no fucking sense. And it's just, yeah, it's just ugly and like scales weird, but it's accessible.
Right.
Right. It's not perfect. It's like people can look at it and go like, well, I can achieve that because I'm not perfect. You know,
yeah,
and I can remix it. And stuff like Friday Night Funkin', Minecraft is super immensely popular. And
Spencer can talk about Friday Night Funkin' for days.
Yeah. And like the lore, the deep lore in like these small channels.
Oh, and then girlfriend comes and then blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And there's all these like little niches too. So like there's these micro channels of like, you know, people who only have like 10,000 subscribers or whatever on YouTube who do mashups of Friday Night Funkin' and Undertale or whatever. And so he'll tell me all these like storylines that are going on. And I'm like, that's really cool, dude.
Right. Yeah.
I don't understand what you're talking about, but it's great that this is inspiring something in you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about. I never really thought about Flip Grip in that way, but I think when you think about it as an analog, it's like the hardware analog to that, where Nintendo releases this thing that is configurable, mm-hmm, right? You have these Joy-Cons, mm-hmm, they're removable. That's mm-hmm the whole you know, conceit of the system.
Yeah.
But then being able to take that, I think, and, you know, literally flip it.
So I think also one thing that I really admire about your work and drive is that you took the Labo mindset and played with and ran with that in a way that I haven't even seen Nintendo do, which is great. Because like, you're right, Nintendo made the Switch to be this kind of like configurable thing. And a lot of the early like promo stuff was like, well, this Joy-Con has HD rumble and you can pretend that it's a glass that has ice in it. You can shake the ice and stuff.
Yeah. Or you can go, you know, create like a fishing reel. Yeah. And like
Nintendo always has these strange experiments where they've got like a blood pressure monitor or like something, you know, that they're
tinkering with. Sensor.
But they never really follow through with it. And they've gotten really close with Labo, but it didn't really, you know, make an impact. But then you did like a exercise bike controlled like Labo thing.
Yeah. I can definitely, I mean, Labo's my favorite thing, I think, probably ever. You know, it, I remember when it first came out, I remember watching the first, like, maybe 20 seconds of the trailer and being like, I remember thinking, this is kind of a macabre thought, but I thought, you could just take that, whatever Labo is, and just put it as my headstone, because it represents so much of what I think is cool. The cardboard, just like this very hacky thing. I mean, I was really into, and I still am really into like STEM education. I think that that's so really, really cool, making engineering accessible. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people didn't buy Labo because it's prohibitively expensive. Yeah. But, you know, if you look at the way Nintendo tried to educate kids about engineering through it, it's really compelling stuff. Yeah. Like they have this whole thing where they do an X-ray shot of the Joy-Con. You see all the components and stuff inside
of it. The design of the tutorial and everything
is good.
Yeah.
From like a user experience designer perspective, I am like, this is incredible.
Right. Like who's working on this? Yeah. You know, Nintendo, like I want to be on this team. And so, you know, I took all that energy that I had felt from seeing that and just that inspiration. And I thought, wow, it would be really cool to, well, the way that Labo Fit came about was, well, so I guess what I should explain is a couple months back, I said I created this exercise bike that connects to Mario Kart, and it's under the brand name Labo Fit Adventure Kart.
Yeah. And you did a little promo video. We can link in the show notes.
Yeah. That is, I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up being the most, like my life's greatest work, that 25 minute video that I spent 9 months making.
Yeah.
Basically I was playing, I created this challenge for myself where I was playing Tetris 99, which I'm not very good at. And I also don't exercise. If you listen to this, you should, one thing you should know about me, I don't exercise. It's not a thing that I'm good at. But I thought, okay, I'm going to try and exercise. I'm going to try and pedal on this bike while I play Tetris 99. And I'm going to try and not stop pedaling until I die, which isn't very hard because I'm not very good.
Sure.
And so And I thought, wow, this is really cool. If only there was some way that I could get it so that this exercise bike was connected to the Switch. And I thought, oh, if maybe if I stop pedaling, it just turns off the Switch or unplugs the... It was very, very much more brutal than...
Yeah, motivation there.
I love it.
And then eventually that evolved into, well, why don't I put it in a Mario Kart? That makes a lot more sense. And then I just kind of... That's an example of a project where, because it was a personal project, I really decided... I had just come off of Flipgrip. You know, having developed Flipgrip for so long, like I said, I wasn't consuming content. I certainly wasn't working on anything else during that time.
Yeah.
And so I had just come up with, oh my gosh, probably like 200 ideas during that time of things that I wanted to do. During the development of Flipgrip, that's actually when Nintendo had their Labo competition. I don't know if you knew about that, but they had this whole competition where if you could integrate Labo into a thing that was, you know, this unique, whatever it is, whatever the coolest project was, they would give you this cardboard colored Nintendo Switch.
Oh my God, no way.
Yeah, and it was a like three of a kind Nintendo Switch that was covered in, like, you know, had this cardboard aesthetic.
Whoa.
Yeah, and so it broke my heart because I remember I was actually I was in China for Flipgrip at the time, manufacturing Flipgrip, and I remember thinking, I can't do this.
Oh no.
Yeah. And so I had come up with a million ideas for it.
Yeah.
And I still have some that I still want to do. But one of those was, you know, hey, you know, some output of that ended up being LaboFit Adventure Kart Kid. And yeah. And I mean, that's to me, that's an example of a project where, unlike Flipgrip, I decided to let it scope creep as much as I wanted. So I just kept adding stuff and adding stuff and adding stuff. And I was like, hey, I should do this. And I just kept adding it. And that's how it ended up becoming this, you know, 9 month long project. Yeah. You should definitely watch it if you're listening to this.
I'm curious. So, you know, you've taken two different approaches, right? One, it's like you had this sort of like perfect, like, I know exactly what I need to do. And here's all the things. One weekend.
Yeah.
And 95% of this project was complete, right? Whereas like something else is just like completely opposite. So what were your, you know, favorite things about each, and what were the most challenging things about each?
Well, I think, you know, they're both aspects of creation that I love. You know, I think even though Flipgrip, the majority of its physical form was, you know, conceived in one weekend, there was so much about taking a product like that through production, actually doing all the people, the Fangamer didn't have the personality, experience, like the people to be able to help me with, you know, the engineering aspect of that, right? And that's just because it's not the kind of products that they make. And so to have ownership over that and take it to China, I mean, I'd worked on lots of products, but to really own a physical thing that was going out to people and was going to, you know, be something that people paid money for. It was very exhilarating. It's very scary. But, you know, having that, I think one thing that I really loved about Flipgrip was the holistic nature of it. I talked a little bit about this, like doing all the graphic design, doing all the packaging design, doing a bunch of the marketing and all this sort of thing, the soup to nuts nature of it. Like in my job, I do a lot of soup to nuts stuff where I take a concept and I take it to production. But it was in the other orthogonal dimension of like doing everything. And that was, I loved that because I'm probably a control freak. It felt like really putting myself into something. And I really loved that. And I think part of that is what ended up coming out in LaboFit, which is I wanted to really do, I wanted to do everything. So I made a fake package for, I made a fake box for it. You know, I did the whole video. There's all these animations. I got a lot of help with the animations, but there's all these animations. I made an amiibo for it, you know? So it was sort of trying to take that even one step further and obviously not selling it. I think that was really gratifying about that project, and really that forces me to push the fringe of my skill set out like one degree maybe a few degrees to be able to try and learn, oh, how do you edit a 25 minute long video? It's really hard and it's very difficult.
It takes a long time. Well, do you feel like your like motivations and your ability to determine what you need to grow is based on your like growth mindset? Because like it's something we talk about a lot with the kids and on the podcast and together as partners, you know, growth versus fixed mindset. And I feel like, you know, you and like John Kay and the people at Fangamer, like I never once heard no from John. Yeah. Right? Like, he never said something is impossible. It's always like,
yes, and.
Yes, and.
Yeah.
There will be challenges, but yeah. we can try it. Right. And so whenever I've worked with John, and I've been working with him for over a decade now, it's a joy because it's just like, what is possible? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Let's figure it out. Right. But I think that there are, that's a blocker for a lot of people. When they, when you have more of a fixed mindset, it's less about like,
but we can't do this, and we can't do that, and we can't figure this out.
And with like, Avery, our fourth grader, his teacher is actually doing growth mindset as part of the curriculum, which is really cool. And she's really into like, well, I can't do that yet. And yet is the key word.
Right.
Yes.
So is that something that you think about? There's something that you've like practiced, the difference between growth and fixed mindset?
You know, I think it's interesting to think that in terms of the dichotomy between the two projects that we're talking about, because with FlipRip, there was a lot of times where I said no, because it was, you know, something like, oh, well, you know, let's put a battery in there. Why not? And I was like, no, we're not doing that.
Charge the device.
Right. And they're like, well, why don't we make it so that when you put the switch in the FlipRip, and this is something I actually talk quite a lot about whenever I'm talking about FlipRip, but people talk about, hey, put the switch in the FlipRip and it charges the FlipRip. It's a battery pack too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, From a product bullet point standpoint, it's just one line.
Right.
But from a hardware development standpoint, I was like, there's a battery in this thing now. Like, batteries explode and do all these, you know, unpredictable things. And they're also just, it takes longer to get to the product.
Yeah.
Which in my mind, I remember very, very
the compliance side of that just gets blown wide open.
Totally.
I've done compliance work.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know all about that. And so, I mean, not even that, but from a development standpoint, right? And so for me, I think that was really interesting for FlipGrip because this is turning into a FlipGrip podcast, but you know, I remember being very, very adamant saying, okay, what does this thing need to do?
Yeah.
It just needs to rotate the switch 90 degrees, feel good, click the things in, and boom, it works.
Yeah.
What is the bare MVP, the minimum viable product to do that, and nothing else, because that will, I wrote a whole post on the Kickstarter page about this because people obviously had all these questions.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, this is, all these things are going to prevent us from making the product itself, from actually shipping it.
Yeah.
And that's the most important, you know, we talk about it a lot, but that's the most important aspect of it is actually it existing in the world. And these were going to be, you know, things that would impede.
And solving that particular problem that you started off with.
And that tends to be, like, you were talking about scope creep earlier, like a lack of vision or a lack of adherence to a core vision is one of the major ways that people do engage in scope creep and prevent themselves from shipping things.
Right.
Like, that's what I do in user experience design is I help define vision and help people like remind them of the vision, right? And it's the same thing where it's like, the FlipGrip only needs to do one thing really, really well.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't need to do a lot of other things that distract from it.
One major use case.
It just needs to do the one thing.
Right. Right.
And that increases the quality of the product, the usefulness of the product, and the lifetime usefulness of the product.
Yeah.
For that use case.
Yeah.
It does it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think what, so I was really adamant about that early on. So it meant saying no to a lot of these ideas where I was like, oh, well, it would be really nice if we could do these things, but, you know, being really adamant about that. And I think the complete flip side of that is when and that's really very practical. It's very pragmatic, right? Cause it's about it shipping, right? Those things don't matter if it's either unreliable or if it just doesn't exist in the first place.
You're not saying it's not possible. You're just saying like,
It's not as important.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the thing is, I think for me, the reason why I was grounded in that reality is because I have developed products that have batteries in them and I need to go through all these compliance things. And I've developed medical devices and those have all kinds of these things. And so for me, I think I was very lucky, like I said, to have the experiences that I've had up until that point, even just the, you know, relatively few professional experiences that I would have throughout my whole career enough to clarify my, you know, my reality enough. Yeah. I was like, this is going to be really difficult, even if it doesn't have any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So I, you know.
And like, it's good that you had that experience from like a product development standpoint. But, you know, when it comes to fulfillment and shipping of batteries as well, that is a whole other compliance world.
Totally. Too. Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. And that was also the time when Nintendo Switch, I don't know if people remember this, but there was all this thing about the docks and like these third-party docks that were like lighting on fire and, you know, USB-C is like this whole nightmare. Yeah. And I was like, I don't want to touch that with like a 10-foot pole. So like,
you don't want to see a news report of somebody who's died because of something that you made right. for a video game. Yeah, you know?
Like, I mean, hoverboards caught on fire and right. killed people.
Yeah.
It's true. You know? And so.
Yeah. Yeah. Flip grip. More like death grip.
No. Hasn't killed anybody yet.
Exactly. Growth like mindset. Yeah.
And so, you know, I was, I'd grown a lot through that project. And I think, like I said, the flip side of that is Lava Fit, where it's, you know, not, it's not going to ship. It's right. really just, I mean, both of those were done in my free time, quote unquote, while working an actual, you know, job. But, you know, the flip side of that is when I'm making something for myself, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, sure. Let's add that in there. Like, oh, cool. Like, we'll add this feature in as well. Like, add the a Ring Fit Adventure ring into it. Sure. Why not? Yeah, let's just throw it in there.
Because you don't have to think about replicating it again and again and again to a certain standard.
Yeah. And I think part of that is, and I say this partially in jest, is that you kind of have to just value your time at zero. When you're a creator, you're like, you know what? This is going to be like a lot of time, but you know what? Doesn't matter.
That's really difficult to do.
Right. Yeah.
That is super difficult.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. So I feel like we can talk about this and talk to Mike for days.
True.
So I think we need to get Mike back here for more episodes.
Yeah. We probably should wrap up pretty soon.
I know.
But yes. Is there anything that we missed talking about other than cooking? I don't know.
I could talk about Korean food for days.
So what's the next thing that you are looking forward to cooking? What's your next problem to tackle?
I have a kitchen now, which I mean, like,
oh my God, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. I mean, it's huge and I can cook with flame now. I just got a wok. And so I spent like 5 hours the other day, just like, I actually probably could have used some of your equipment because I was like inhaling all these fumes from trying to season this wok with like a blowtorch. I mean, you saw it on Instagram.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to getting into some high heat cooking. Nice.
Kenji Lopez Alt has a wok cookbook coming out.
That's right. Yeah. I'm all on that.
Yes.
And so I'm really excited to cook some stuff with that. And, you know, seasoning is so poetic because it's like, you know, the more you cook with it, it gets, you know, better and you get better. And it's this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's all this mindfulness thing.
I can't wait until I get a wok burner.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad has one of those.
Oh,
it's so cool.
Living the dream.
It's also very scary. But you both are not afraid of fire at all, so.
No, I love fire.
Run towards fire.
I got to play with fire every day. I realize this is a need for me.
Yeah, Chris messaged me and was like, oh, yeah, you know, we were thinking about getting this wok burner. And I was like, yeah, it is. It's kind of scary. You know, it's like a lot of fire. And I was like, wait, you guys have like a whole forge in your garage.
We're fine.
Never mind.
Yeah.
I'm just scared.
About fire and knives, like, you know, Chris got me a switchblade, right? And
I didn't get you a switchblade.
You didn't?
No, they're illegal.
No, they're not illegal. It's illegal to carry in Washington.
So you don't carry that? You don't carry
it? I don't carry it.
It's decorative.
I own one.
Okay.
I own one, and
no
it stays with me at home.
No cops should be listening to this podcast anyway, so hopefully we're fine.
Yeah, because ACAB. But no, really, like, it's not illegal to own one. Yeah. It's illegal to carry a spring-loaded knife in King County.
Got it.
Yeah, so, like, switchblade or jackblade or whatever. Because jackblades open up the other way.
A jackknife?
A jackknife, yes. And then switchblade opens up, like, that way, and jackknife opens up the other way, whatever. But anyway... what was I talking about?
You want to forge? You're gonna forge a dagger?
We were talking about woks.
Yes.
Yeah.
No. We're talking
about how scary fire is.
Oh yeah. And then, but yeah, not. Oh, I was really scared of knives before.
Yeah.
And you know, like spring loaded knives, and now I'm just like.
Yeah.
Like
that's awesome.
Same thing with like, you know, fire. It's like my forge is usually running at like 2,000 degrees.
Yeah. So yeah.
It's pretty hot.
Yeah, it is pretty hot. Yeah.
So what are you, this could be the segment at the end of the show where we talk about your, what
I know,
you're looking forward
I'm
to.
Really.
What's your knife making update for this week?
I have so many blades that I've been working on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I'm just kind of like stalling on, I'm fixated on the blades because I'm kind of psyching myself out from like finishing a whole knife. But, you know, I was talking about the other day, one of my friends was recently diagnosed with leukemia, and it's been kind of hard. And so I think I've been thinking a lot about how creation negates destruction. And so thinking about her has really inspired me to make more knives.
Wow.
And so I started making a dagger for her.
Mm-hmm.
And
to stab cancer.
In the butt!
In the butt!
And I really want that to be like the first knife that I finished by myself.
Oh, that
is this
amazing.
Like knife for her.
Yeah.
And this dagger. And I've got like this really cool handle material picked out, and it's time. I'm ready.
What is a forcing function for you right there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such an amazing story. And what an awesome motivator.
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
And so it's like, you know, whenever I talk to her, I'm just like, yeah, you know, I can give you any of these knives that I'm working on right now because I think about you when I make them all.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So
that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's my thing. I'm using this as my forcing function because now if I don't finish a knife, shame on me.
Yeah.
That's right. Cool. For me, one thing I'm looking forward to next week is finishing up our Halloween carnival stuff.
Wow.
So we are like, our kids go to a small school, and normally in the before times, there would be a big Halloween carnival. The parents take over the whole school for like a day and transform the school into like Hogwarts or something, you know, for the kids, right? Mm-hmm. It's kindergarten through fifth grade. But this year, don't tell any of the kids because the theme is secret. For any of the Tilden kids listening to this podcast,
you better turn it off right now.
Turn it down. The theme is just Halloween, right? So because they haven't had like a proper Halloween.
Yeah.
Especially like the kindergartners and stuff that are new to school, or like first graders who didn't have the kindergarten Halloween experience like last year.
Yeah. So in previous years, you know, we volunteered. I've done some design of like the hallway, the entrance hallway and stuff, and just done a bunch of big installation pieces for it. And this year we're doing the photo booth. Mm-hmm. So we're making a photo booth backdrop that's Halloween themed. We're also going to be doing, we're bringing our DSLR to do pictures. Normally they would do, you know, nice DSLR pictures and then print them and then give them to the kids later.
Mm-hmm.
This year we're going to be doing Instax photos.
Yeah.
So the kids can just take them there.
That's awesome.
And have it to, you know, look at when they're there. So very much looking forward to the Halloween project finishing.
You know, it's interesting that you say this is like the first, or this is like, they've not had a Halloween. Because for me, I grew up in apartment buildings my whole life. And so this is my first Halloween being in like a cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
And I have to get some candy or else I'm going to, like, kids are going to show up to my door and be like, here's some seaweed.
You might appreciate it.
It's healthy. Parents would like it.
Yeah, you got to watch out for those teenagers, man. They're pretty, they're pretty demanding.
Yeah.
Here's two seaweeds.
No, it is nice that, you know, Chris and I get to do this together.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Because you hadn't had time in previous years with work and stuff.
Yeah, I've never really been able to, like, you know, be involved in, like, school stuff just because I was working a corporate gig. And so now I get to do all this stuff, you know. I get to be there for, like, pick up and drop off and...
Life.
I know.
Life. What
I know.
Is life?
Well, and you know, one life? More thing that I'm really looking forward to, I'm going to hijack for a minute here. Mm-hmm. I joined the Northwest Blacksmiths Association. There is one. And it's really cool because there's a lot of really great like metal workers in the Pacific Northwest area. And so there's an association, there's an event next weekend called Swaptoberfest, where, you know, it's just like a big gathering of like, you know, all these folks, trade swaps and demonstrations, you know, like food, potlucks, people selling stuff. And
wow.
Yeah.
Janine, it doesn't sound like you're an aspiring knife maker. You're in this the Northwest Blacksmiths Association. I think that doesn't mean you're aspiring.
She has the t-shirt.
I have the t-shirt.
You got the t-shirt. All right.
I think you're right. I think that she should just call herself.
I'm going to drop it.
All right. Well, this has been lovely. Mike, if people want to follow you on the internet, how would they do that? How do they find your stuff?
You can find me most places at Mecha Choi, MECHACHOI. Or a lot of people say Mecha Choi, but they're wrong.
Okay. Don't be wrong.
If you follow Mike on Twitter or Instagram, you post about your Twitch streams.
Yeah. You can probably the best place is on Twitter. That's where most of the stuff goes. But yeah, you can find me on Twitch if you want to hear some relaxing video game music. I've been doing a lot more of that recently. So that's been super fun. And if you just want to see, if you want to watch my YouTube videos, youtube.com/MegaChoi. And there's just a smattering of different types of videos there. Some are music, some are definitely not music. Cool. So
we'll put that in the show notes as well if y'all are listening and want to check it out. Check out our website at whatislifepodcast.com. Like and subscribe, leave a review if you want or don't. You can support the show just by listening, and we really appreciate you being here. So thanks Mike for being our first in-person co-host.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thanks. Bye. Y'all
see you next time.
Bye.
Like, it's super interesting to me because, like I said, like I make a lot of stuff, but this is totally like orthogonal to my,
right,
to my whole world of making things.
Yeah.
But if you have any sort of engineering mindset, you can figure it out, right? And so that's kind of how Jenny started.
That's the thing. It's like, if you've got a process oriented mind, and you know how to like just break things down, right? You know, there's like this whole, there's a whole knife making process, but it's like maybe 7 big steps or something, right? Yeah. And if you can break it down and like, you know, learn how to do each one of those.
So like, this is a good, this is a chart that Jenny was using for this kitchen knife, right?
Yeah.
And it shows you the shapes that you have to get to in abstract, right?
It's like
step by step.
Intentional design form step.
Yeah,
because you're mashing the metal around and moving it around, and then it's gonna react as you're mashing it.
You know what's funny about this is like I'm a mechanical engineer, and so like mechanical engineers, like they learn about annealing,
all that
stuff, right? And then so like on interview questions, they're always like, it's like so silly because no one ever uses it, but it was like, what do you need to do if you want a steel to be like this, or if you want metal to be like this? And there's all these like trick interview questions, you know, and nobody actually uses it.
Yeah,
but you know,
I need that information for knife makers.
Yeah, because I've met a couple of knife makers, and they're the ones who actually know intuitively, intuitively this stuff, and it's like, it's actually like,
Well, because you're also feeling it.
This guy, Laren Thomas, right? Like, I am obsessed with this book, and I'm obsessed with his Instagram account. Knife Steel Nerds.
Yeah.
And he wrote this book.
But what's interesting is like, when you're actually hammering the metal, you do feel the differences in the carbon density versus the, you know, whatever alloy it is, what temperature it is.
For and example, so
you
get a
sense of
this
it.
This is 1095. And
so
this
visceral.
This is 1095 and this is 1084.
Yeah.
There is a material difference in working with these two steels because of the 10%, 11% additional carbon in this steel.
Right.
It is more finicky to work with. It is more finicky to heat treat and quench.
But then you have other benefits down the line. Like if there's more carbon, it's harder.
Probably like a harder blade. And whereas like this is so much easier to work with, right?
Yeah.
But, and it's a lot more forgiving, but this probably holds a better edge.
Yeah, I've done a lot of machining of stuff. Like, like manual mills and stuff.
Yeah.
Mills. And so like there's some of that I have, like if there's lead in something,
yeah, for sure. And that's like that's it. That's what it is.
Hell's Forge.
Yes, this is calcifer.
That's calcifer.
Yes, because you know calcifer likes to guzzle gas. This is Dottie.
Well, this has already been very cool.
Yeah, man.
And then like I have a hammer guy. I don't know if you got to that part of the podcast yet where I was talking about my hammer guy.
No.
And so he makes custom hammers. So that's like my rounding hammer. This is my dog head hammer.
There's all sorts of different paths for like metalsmithing, right?
This is Avery's rounding hammer. So we have like matching.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah, it's so funny because, like, you know when you, like, stop podcast and then you're like, ah, oh, dang it, I gotta go do stuff. I was like, oh, well, I'm gonna go meet them.
We'll just continue it in person somehow.
So I was like, oh, it's getting a good part. Right, I gotta pause this. I guess I gotta go meet him now.
Yeah. But I'm obsessed with daggers, right? So I'm trying to make, like, you know, push dagger or boot dagger style stuff.
That's awesome.
I'm obsessed with that. And then this is like a knife that I've been trying to mimic. One of my friend's knives that he made. It's my Stabby Dex project.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ashe made it.
Yeah, Ashe made this. So,
are you doing these all in parallel to, like, I guess, I mean, you're talking about how you're process oriented. Mm-hmm. Like, are you doing it in parallel so that you can do all the grinding at once and all, like,
I'm just jumping around because I got ADHD and I'm like, okay, I want to do this.
She's doing it because she's procrastinating on finishing a blade because she's afraid of finishing a blade.
It's so cool, though. We'll say that it's you're doing it in batches.
Yeah. Yes. No, but it really is a fear of finishing.
Yeah.
Because I've tied this arbitrary notion in my head that, you know, I still call myself an aspiring knife maker. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm going to drop the knife aspiring when I make my first solo knife. And so now I'm just like, nah, I don't want to do that. I'm still going to be an aspiring knife maker.
I think you're doing it.
Yeah, I do too. That's what I've been trying to tell her. Well, when we were talking about it this morning, I think that there's like, with artists and creators in general, like getting to the point where you actually ship something is such a big hurdle. But then once you get there, like shipping is addictive. Yeah. Finishing projects is addictive, right?
Yeah, we could talk all about that.